Open your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 36 this morning. Isaiah chapter 36. Judah, the land that Isaiah was prophesying about, is now, as we come to this chapter, on the edge or the brink of being overrun by the Assyrian military machine. The Assyrians believe that Judah is just another speed bump in their conquest of the world. But the enemy does not comprehend Jehovah's power and thus willingly chooses to mock Jehovah and God's leadership. So we're going to find in these next four chapters, chapters 36 through 39, that God will not be mocked, nor will he stand idly by, but will defend his people against the Assyrian army. The title of the message today is simply this: When Man Mocks God and His People. As we come here to the book of Isaiah, we are concluding one section, and that is the prophet of punishment, the section of judgment. And basically, the first 35 chapters have been mostly and predominantly about the coming judgment, both on the nation of Israel and Judah, but also on the surrounding nations, including Assyria, who we'll talk about much today. But now we come to a new section. This is the, they call them interlude, or the middle part of the book. This is the section that you go from the transition section. These four chapters transition from punishment to promise. The hope of a Messiah, Isaiah 53. The hope of the coming of the Messiah a second time, much of the second half of the book. But in these four chapters and in this new section, we find a transition over from the Assyrian Empire to the Babylonian Empire. But today we want to talk about Assyria. Look at verse 1, because we have a timestamp, a date. It came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah. Stop right there. If we can determine when Hezekiah ruled, and we can determine how long he ruled, and when he started, we can put a time date on this. And so Hezekiah ruled for 29 years. Notice that this is the 14th year, about halfway through. Now we also will, well, we don't want to get ahead of that. Stick to the sermon, Randy. In the 14th year of Hezekiah, there's another timestamp coming up, but that's a sermon for another day. In the 14th year, we can determine, and this is in your notes, that Isaiah had been called earlier in the book, remember in chapter 6, in the year that King Uzziah died. Do you remember chapter 6? Then Isaiah had a vision of God in chapter 6, but it says in the year of King that Uzziah died. Well, we know that Uzziah died in 740 BC. Okay? Now, we know with that the year that Hezekiah died, because we have one king between them, Ahaz. We find that the year is now 701 BC. Which means, by my calculations, from 740 to 701 is about 40 years that Isaiah has been prophesying to the people of Judah. He has been prophesying against the idolatry and the idolatrous leaders of Judah, predominantly Ahaz. For the next few chapters now, Isaiah is going to deal with the Assyrian-led invasion of Judah and their king, who's almost a name that may not be a household name, but he's going to become a household name in our series, Sennacherib. We should all say that together. Sennacherib. And Sennacherib is going to attack Judah. At this point in time, Assyria has already overrun much of the known world of the area of Israel and Judah, including the northern kingdom of Israel and its capital, Samaria. You remember Israel and Samaria and Ahab? You remember wicked King Ahab and Jezebel? That was from the north. But in 722 BC, Assyria overran the northern half of the 12 tribes. Judah was in the southern half. Israel has been defeated. They have, Sennacherib has attacked other countries and overrun many of them. These two chapters that are coming, Isaiah 36 and 37, are mirrored in 2 Kings 18 to 19. So if you want to get some other details, there's a little nuances that are different, but you can read those chapters. We won't do that today, but we'll refer to them off and on throughout the next couple of messages. But these chapters point back to the Assyrian Empire. Now, let's talk about who the king was. Now, notice it is the king whose name is Hezekiah. He is Ahaz's son. Ahaz was, for the most part, a wicked king of Judah. Hezekiah was one of the few good kings. When I say good, I'm saying they predominantly chose to worship the true God. Back in 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 7, we find that Hezekiah reformed Judah and that God prospered him. Now, how did he do that? The main things that he did was take the worship of false idols and the groves and the high places and destroy them and say, we need to worship God how we used to, how this nation used to, and we need to come back to God. There was a revival, we could say, in the land of Judah. And he wanted the people to take their worship back in the proper way, go back to the temple and worship Jehovah, the true God. 2 Chronicles 29, 1 through 11 gives more details on his reforms. Also, you can read, again, there's lots of extra reading here on these chapters, but chapters 29 through 31 give us more details on this endeavor. Well, at this point, Hezekiah, believing that he is doing what's right before God, and because he's trusting God, he now tells Assyria, who was pestering him, as we're about to see here in the story, who's about ready to attack him, he just tells Assyria, you know what? I believe God now. We're going to quit paying you tribute money. We're going to break our treaty that we've had with you for these many years. And that goes back to Ahaz. Ahaz had gone up to Assyria and made an agreement with them to try to protect them against other enemies like Syria and Israel. And now Hezekiah is feeling pretty good about himself because he's doing what's right, he believes. And he says, you know what? I'm not going to trust Assyria anymore. I'm going to trust God. So he breaks the treaty with this Assyrian king. And of course, you know how the Assyrian king is not going to like that. So Hezekiah feels like he can rebel against the Assyrians, and he refuses to serve them any longer. Well, we come to verse 1, and we see here's what Sennacherib did against that. Look what he does, the rest of the verse. Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the walled or defense cities of Judah, and he took them. Well, Isaiah now writes that this wicked king Sennacherib of Assyria, in retribution and to try to repay the breaking of this treaty, decided, I'm just going to overrun all of Judah and take it over, and it can become one of mine as well. According to historical records, Sennacherib at this point had defeated 46 walled cities of Judah. 46. There left one city, basically, and that was the city, the capital of Judah, we know it as Jerusalem, where Hezekiah lived, where the temple was, where his home was, where still many people of Judah live. But at this point, Sennacherib is beginning to surround Jerusalem in hopes that he can overrun it. And so the Assyrian leader successfully pushed his attacks to the edge of the city. Now, I want you to turn to 2 Kings chapter 18 and look at verse 14, because the story picks up there. And for sake of time, we can't look at all the passages in this sermon today. But if you would like to read more about it, you can read some of these parallel passages that I've written into your notes. 2 Kings 18 and 19 being the predominant ones. You can read 20 as well. We'll come to that later in a couple of messages. But in chapter 18, verse 14, we find some similar words, but we find some extra detail. Here we find Hezekiah, 2 Kings 18:14, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, who, by the way, was at the city of Lachish. That was a Judean city that he had overrun. At the point in the story of the book of Isaiah, as Sennacherib is at the city of Lachish with his army. Okay? And Hezekiah sent to the king of Assyria, who was at Lachish, saying, here's what he said. I'm going to put this in modern language for you. I am sorry. I've offended you. Look at the verse. Look at verse 14. I have offended. Return from me. That which thou puttest on me, I will bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So here's what happened. Hezekiah breaks this treaty. Sennacherib responds by attacking the walled cities. It's getting very close to Hezekiah now. The king of Assyria didn't like that he broke the treaty, so he takes all these cities. He kills thousands of Jews, by the way, in the process. He surrounds Jerusalem, and Hezekiah is sitting in his temple, and he's looking at this military map, and he's saying, this isn't going good for me. I gotta stop this man. So I'm going to just basically say, I am sorry. Would you just leave? Just get away from here. As basically, he's saying, return, get away. It's too much for me. And in fact, he said, what would you like for me to give to you so you could get out of here? And what did the king of Assyria say? He said, I want 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. It's right there in verse 14. And so what did Hezekiah do? A good bargain. If I can get them and I can save the lives of the people in Jerusalem and the rest of the people of Judah that haven't died yet, I'm going to pay them all this great money. And this is a great big sum of money. Thousands of dollars in today's money. But look where he gets the money from. Verse 15, Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord. And in the treasury of the king's house. He literally goes to the temple and he gets all the silver. He goes to his house, gets all the silver, and puts it together to get this all this big, inordinate sum of money. And talents are more of a measure of weight. So he had to get a certain amount of weight in silver. Not only that, look what he did. That time, Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars, which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and he gave it to the king of Assyria. You know what he did? He basically undid some of the things that he had done in order to get rid of the Assyrian king. So there's a section of Hezekiah's life. There's no doubt he's trusting the Lord. And we're going to see it throughout this. But there are a couple of times, as we're also going to see, that Hezekiah struggled with trusting the Lord. And in this case, he is really concerned, so he just hands him a bunch of money. Now, dictators and people like Sennacherib, they'll take money, but they don't stop there, do they? They want what they want. And they know when the nation they're opposing is down and about out. That's where we come to the story today. So turn back. That's kind of your background for where we are going today. And what we have is an outline put together of the historical account of what happens when Assyria sends some ambassadors to have a diplomatic meeting with some of the Judean ambassadors. So in other words, it would be as if our Secretary of State and a couple of his diplomatic friends went and visited another country and their senior diplomats, and they had a meeting in order to try to broker a peace treaty. Does that make sense? That's what's unfolding here between Assyria and Judah in the sermon today. So let's look at this, because in it we find some great lessons of what happens when people mock God. First of all, today, in your notes, starting in verses 2 and 3, what we find is the Assyrian envoy, or the Assyrian ambassadors, meet the Judean ambassadors at a very specific location. And I've called it the washer's field, the field where they did their laundry. Look at verse 2. And the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah with a great army. And he stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. Then came forth unto him Elkiah, Hilkiah's son, which was over the house, and Shebna, the scribe, and Joah, Asaph's son, the recorder. you're probably already ready to throw up your hands and say, that's a lot of names and a lot of information and I'm overwhelmed and can we just go on to the next verse? We can, but there's a great truth that we can see right off the top. But let me set the stage here. At this point in the story, Hezekiah, seeing that Sennacherib was wanting to invade Jerusalem, he commands his princes and his mighty men to do something that is not recorded in this chapter, but it's recorded over in Kings, or actually in 2 Chronicles. And he commands his men to stop the flow of water outside the city. Okay, that plays into this verse. This was for two reasons. He's going to basically dam up the water supply that is going outside the city walls. Number one, it's to stop the enemy from having water from inside of Jerusalem. Because as they're getting closer, they are able to overcome the aqueduct or conduit or piping system that of the water that was flowing to a place called the Fuller's Field, which was a place outside the city or the Washer's Field where you went and you took your clothes or maybe your animals or things that needed to be washed and you washed them out there. And there was a piping system from inside the city that went outside. Well, Hezekiah was like, I'm not going to give any water to the Assyrian army. Not only that, he realized they were surrounded and their own water supply was going to run out. So he needed every extra drip of water, he felt, to save it for his people inside the city walls. So that is in 2 Chronicles 32, verse 4. But notice that this meeting between a man named Rabshakeh and some other representatives of Hezekiah happens at a very specific location. Notice where Rabshakeh stood. He stood by the conduit or the pipe or the aqueduct of the upper pool in the highway of that field. Friends, you may think that is unimportant. And you may be like, why is he emphasizing this? And you will not probably remember, but there was a very important meeting earlier in the book of Isaiah at this same location. And you can read about it in Isaiah chapter 7. 33 years earlier, Isaiah the prophet met King Ahaz at this location. And what you may not remember is that one of the greatest signs in the Bible came out of that meeting. We won't look at it, but here's the background. Ahaz, who was a wicked king of Judah, the father of Hezekiah, was very concerned that day about an impending military invasion of Judah. Not by Assyria, but by Israel and Syria. They had already invaded Judah once and done a lot of damage. Now listen. In response, Isaiah is sent to tell Ahaz this word. Israel and Syria will not defeat you. That's what he tells him at this exact location. Do you want to know what Ahaz did in response? Do you remember what Ahaz did? Probably not. You know what he did? He said, I'm not going to trust the Lord. I'm actually going to go to another nation and ask him to militarily help me. Do you want to guess which nation that was? Assyria. And he goes to Assyria and he asks that nation, by the way, while he's there, he makes the blueprints for a wicked god, a false god, and sets up a false idol to that god, a replica of the Assyrian false god. He brings it back to Judah and Jerusalem and sets it up. But he asks Assyria for help. So instead of trusting God, he goes to Assyria. Meanwhile, Isaiah promises Israel and Syria will not defeat you. By the way, that's true. And he says to the king, I want to give you a sign that it's going to be true. And you know what Ahaz said? No, I don't want your sign. But Isaiah gave him the sign anyway. And you know what the sign was? Behold, a virgin will conceive. That's Isaiah chapter 7. That was the sign. A virgin would conceive and bear forth a son, and his name will be called Emmanuel. That's all part of that story. Now, why, you might say, would I bring that up today? Isaiah, 33 years earlier, had told Ahaz, don't fear the king of Syria, don't fear the king of Israel, but instead of listening to Isaiah, the king asked Assyria to help defeat his enemies. Let me say it today, and it's in your notes. Ahaz's choice that day to beg for Assyria's help was now bearing its full harvest. Because 33 years later, guess who is sitting outside the city of Jerusalem? The Assyrian army. The very nation that Ahaz asked to help is now about ready to defeat all of Judah. The consequences, friends, of not obeying God are on full display. You might think your actions today don't receive any consequences. Well, friends, 33 years later, the consequences are obvious. The actions and trust that Ahaz put in Assyria bore fruit in the death of thousands of Judean people. Ahaz had truly rejected the word of the Lord and instead trusted the Assyrians. The Assyrians are now meeting at the same location, and it is a stark reminder of the faithfulness of this king, Ahaz. And in the background, though, stands a faithful prophet of God who once again finds himself promoting the one and only true promise-keeping God, and that is Jehovah. So that is the background. That's where this diplomatic meeting happens. So now the Assyrians send their main senior diplomat. You'll notice in verse 2, his name is Rabshakeh. You can pronounce it however you want, but that's the easiest way I'm going to use it because I got to say his name a whole bunch in this sermon. His name means chief wine pourer, but it's probably not a specific name, more of a title, representative of a military title than a personal name. In fact, a lot of commentaries call it the Rabshakeh, the military diplomat, or main military man, if I could say it that way. And throughout, what we're going to find, point number 2 today, is that Rabshakeh is going to speak to these diplomats of Judah at the washer's field, and he is going to ridicule Jehovah. He is going to mock Hezekiah and Judah. So let's find out today what happens. It's an amazing story, and it sets the stage for the rest of these four chapters here in Isaiah 36 to 39. Rabshakeh, verse 4, said unto them, say now to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? Rabshakeh now comes in this senior or in this diplomatic meeting, and he proclaims to the ambassadors of Judah. By the way, those three ambassadors are named in verse 3, Elkiam, Shebna, and Joah. Those are the three names of the ambassadors of Judah who came to talk to the ambassadors of Assyria. I know it's hard to keep this all straight. And Rabshakeh challenges these people, and he proclaims to the ambassador to Judah a message that he wants them to come to deliver back to King Hezekiah. And the main message of this chapter is on who Judah would choose to trust in. You see, Assyria has surrounded them. Rabshakeh is saying, well, now you're stuck. You have nowhere to go. Who are you going to trust in to defeat us? Notice, by the way, he doesn't even call Hezekiah by his official title. He just calls him Hezekiah. But notice what, in this verse, Rabshakeh says about his king. Notice the mockery and the boasting starts right off the top. He says, go tell Hezekiah, doesn't call him king. He says, go tell Hezekiah that my great king, he'll use that term several times in this, my great king, the king of Assyria, says this, who are you going to trust in now that you are surrounded by my great king? Rabshakeh is rude. He is arrogant. And he ridicules, even as we're about to see, Jehovah himself. This man is an unbeliever. He is a wicked man, and he is representing a wicked nation. Assyria, let me remind you, was barbaric. They did things that I don't even know if I want to repeat to you what they did to the people that they overran in their countries. Wicked things. He begins the monologue then by referring to Hezekiah. What we find in this next few verses is that he had utter disdain for the people and God of Judah. And pridefully, he lifted up his own king. And it demonstrates one of the most insolent speeches in the entire Bible. Friends, let me remind you that your choice of words means something. And let us be careful how we lift ourselves up and put others down, because that's exactly what this man did throughout this message. Let me continue. Verse 5. He says, I say, sayest thou, but they are but vain words. I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom dost thou trust that thou rebellest against me? Next, Rabshakeh challenges the envoy from, or the ambassadors from Judah, who claimed that they now had the strategy and military strength sufficient to oppose Assyria. He proceeds to inform them that Judah is only deceiving themselves to think they can defeat the Assyrians. Let me say it this way. Here in modern language is this verse. Here is what Rabshakeh thunders to the people of Judah. You think you have strength to battle us for war, but all that adds up to is but mere lip talk or empty words. You know the old phrase, actions speak louder than words? Well, this one is words speak, but no actions behind it. You know what he was doing? He was saying to Judah, he was saying, you talk a big talk, but we know you're not strong enough to back up your talk. You think you're strong enough to defeat us as the Assyrian military, but let me tell you, you won't even come close. All you are is a bunch of talk and no action. He continues in verse 6. And what he does in the next couple of verses is tell the people of Judah, Rabshakeh, the Assyrian representative, what he tells the people of Judah is, you basically have only two choices to trust. If you're going to think, because I'm already telling you, Rabshakeh says, you're not strong enough by yourself to defeat the Assyrian military, we've got you surrounded. But I'll give you the two choices that you might think you could rely on. And then he mocks them because of it. Look in verse 7 or 6. Well, let's see the first choice. If you will trust in the staff of the broken reed on Egypt, wherein if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all that trust in him. Rabshakeh now declares in these next couple of verses that Judah ultimately has only two choices if they're going to even have a chance to defeat us. Here's the choice, first choice, Egypt. Egypt. Here is what Rabshakeh says about Egypt. Here's what the Assyrians think about Egypt. To place your trust in Egypt, Judah, is folly, because all he is a wounded enemy who will provide little help against us as a strong Assyrian army. In fact, he gives him a picture. What's the picture, friends? What is Egypt like at this point in history? And by the way, he's right on this. Egypt has been very weak. It has become very weak as a military power. But you notice the description? Did you catch what he said? He said, you're trusting in a staff that's only representative of a broken reed. Now, friends, what's a staff? I think the first thing that we think of a staff is kind of like a shepherd who holds a kind of a strong stick in his hand. We could call this a walking stick, but I suppose it's probably bigger than that. It's a staff, and it's a big, long stick, and it's something that is used to support someone, right? And so Rabshakeh says, well, Egypt is representative of the staff, but all that it actually is now, what used to be a strong support and a strong military, is just a broken piece of grass or a broken reed. You know what a reed, like the bulrushes and the reeds that Moses' boat was placed into along the Nile River? Okay? Not a little blade of grass, but, you know, kind of a thicker piece. But that's much less sturdy than a staff or a strong stick. And in fact, Rabshakeh mocks Egypt and he says, well, try leaning upon a staff that is broken. Now, I got to be careful to have too many illustrations or the sermon will get too long. But if any of you were to use a cane and it was broken, you probably wouldn't use it Even worse, he says, if you try to use it, the broken stick is splintered. It would be like leaning on it, putting your hand on it, and here's what would happen. This is what it means to trust Egypt, he says. Put your hand on it, and the splinters go right through your hand. So not only is it a bad idea to lean your weight on Egypt, you're actually going to be hurt more if you trust in Egypt. Others had tried to rely on Egypt during this time period, and it hadn't gone too well for them. You can take a look at 2 Kings 17, verse 4, and Ephraim. They had trusted Egypt. That didn't go very well. At this time in history, Egypt had proved to be unreliable in assisting or defeating an enemy as strong as Assyria. And friends, do you remember who Hezekiah sent to go see earlier in the book? He sent some of his own ambassadors. It's possible it's some of these people, Shebna, Elkayam. You know where he sent them to try to get help against Assyria? You got it, Egypt. And Isaiah spoke and said, do not trust in Egypt. Rabshakeh is saying the same thing. Don't trust in Egypt, it won't be help. But then he goes on, he says, you only have one other option. If Egypt's not going to help you, you're surrounded by my army, then your only other option is to trust, verse 7, but if you say to me, and that's Hezekiah is going to say to us, or Judah, we're going to choose to trust in Jehovah. That's the second option. We're going to trust in the Lord our God. Then watch what Rabshakeh says. He says, but isn't it your God whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath cut down and said to Judah and Jerusalem, you have to worship before this altar? Okay, Rabshakeh is mixed up. Rabshakeh is confused. He gives another option, Jehovah, and he says this, suppose you say you want to trust in the Lord your God. In response to the statement about Egypt, Rabshakeh assumes that the ambassadors will replace or respond with a statement of trust in God. He doesn't even give them a chance to say the other option. In other words, Rabshakeh says, don't trust in Egypt. The reply by the ambassadors, if they were from Hezekiah and what Hezekiah, who he was trusting in, the natural reply would have been, well, we're not going to trust in Egypt. We're going to trust in the Lord. He doesn't even let him say it. He just goes right on and keeps saying, don't worry. You don't even need to bring up the Lord your God. Just forget him. Don't trust in him. But at this point, Rabshakeh brings up Hezekiah's reforms. By the way, Rabshakeh seems to know a lot about what was going on in Judah. I don't know if there were some spies that had infiltrated or if word just had gotten out and it was common knowledge. You got to remember, they didn't have newspapers and email and the way, but Rabshakeh knew what Hezekiah had been doing inside of Judah. And he correctly says, Hezekiah has been reforming the land. Had Hezekiah been cutting down the altars and the groves? Yes. But here's the problem. He got mixed up on which God was which. See, he thought, Rabshakeh thought, that the groves and the high places of worship throughout Judah were actually representative of Jehovah. And he says, well, Hezekiah, you don't trust in God. Why would you trust in God? You've just got rid of all your idols. You got rid of all those things to Jehovah. He's now powerless. That's essentially what he's saying. But obviously there's a problem. He didn't really understand what it meant for the king Hezekiah to do this, to remove the places of idol worship, and to show that Judah was no longer going to trust in these false gods, but instead actually going to trust in Jehovah. But his thinking was this. If Hezekiah had destroyed the places of God worship, and I put that little g, the false gods, then God, capital G, would be no help to Judah. In other words, why trust in Jehovah? You've gotten rid of all of the idols for him. He's powerless. Friends, let me tell you, the Assyrian military, as we're going to see in a couple of weeks, would find out how strong Jehovah really was. But Rav Sheka was confusing two types of worship. Rav Sheka appears to know much about the land. He knows about the Jewish people. He knows about their culture. But he errs in his understanding of what true and false religious worship in Judah was all about. So in this, the Assyrian ambassador blundered, for he thought that destroying the idols was an act against Jehovah, when in actuality, what Hezekiah was doing was in support of true worship and of Jehovah. But in Rabshakeh's eyes, the Jews had no help from people on earth, that would be Egypt, and they certainly had no help from any deities or from the heavens, because they had cut down all their idols. What he was painting to Hezekiah and to his ambassadors was, you have no choice but to obey what I'm about to say. You have no enemy that will defend you. You have nobody to trust in. We have you surrounded. So you need to listen to what I'm about to say. Verse 8. At this point, Rabshakeh is going to try to bargain with the Jews. Man, this man, he could be a diplomat of diplomats. And he is ready to do the bargaining. He believes he's got Judah right where he wants him, at the bargaining table. Now therefore, he said, start giving us our money again. Give your pledges. Look at verse 8. Start up your tribute money again. They weren't good enough with the 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. Instead, he says, give your pledges, I pray thee, to my master, the king of Assyria. And by the way, I'll give you something in exchange. You know, if you promise to sign on the dotted line that you will give your monthly tribute money, whatever amount, doesn't matter, and start serving us again, start serving the master. In other words, you'll become our servant. We're your master. We've got you surrounded. You have nowhere to hope. You have nowhere to hide. You have no one that's going to help you. So give him your money, and in exchange, what does he say he's going to give to them? 2,000 horses. Now that sounds like a good change here, friends. 2,000 horses. Do you remember something about horses earlier? Do you remember that the people of Judah went down to Egypt? And what did they ask Egypt for? Give us help against Assyria. And could you specifically, what did they ask for? Horses. And God had said to the people of Israel and the people of Judah, don't trust in horses. Some trust in horses and some in chariots, but we will trust in the name of the Lord our God. And here we have, and this Assyrian diplomat saying, if you just promise to go back paying the pledge that you were before your king broke it, then we'll give you 2,000 horses. And then look what he says to them. He mocks them. If you have enough riders to even put on them. Mm-hmm. You know what he was doing? He was basically saying, your military is worthless. If you can even find 2,000 strong men to ride those horses. So having pointed out that he believed it was futile to trust in Egypt or Jehovah, he certainly thought the people of Judah were now backed into a corner. And now he says, I'll give you horses. Do you think this would have been something that perhaps these ambassadors, we don't know this for sure, if these were the same ambassadors that had gone down to Egypt looking for horses, this guy was really smart. Because you know what he said? We'll give you the very horses Egypt couldn't give you. Tantalizing. But he presses on, verse 9. How then wilt thou turn away the face of one captain, the least of my master's servants, and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Rabshakeh presses on. He says, well, if you don't accept my offer, if you don't accept my offer of 2,000 horses, how do you think any of your men will defeat even one of the lowest of my captains or of the Assyrian captains? If you don't take those horses, how do you think you're going to stand up against me? You say you want to put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen, but you don't take my horsemen. You are dumb, basically what he says, to not take this. because you won't even defeat one of my small military men, one of my captains with any of your military, without these horses. How dare you defy the great king of Assyria and not accept this offer? You'll trust Egypt and their horses, but you won't take my horses. And so the officer, Rabshakeh, attempts to show the utter folly for what the Jews were choosing to do. Then look what he says in verse 10. And one of the most amazing verses in all the Bible, frankly. And one of the most amazing statements in all of the scripture is this verse right here. And he says, "And am I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? The Lord said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it." Let me put the first phrase as Rabshakeh continues. This is Rabshakeh speaking. Let me put it in a little more modern English, that first phrase. "Furthermore," he adds, "do you think I have come up to fight you without the Lord?" He continues, "It is the Lord who actually told us to come up against your land and to destroy it." Rabshakeh is the Assyrian ambassador who says, "It is the Lord who is telling us to defeat you, the people of Judah." That's a shocking statement. It was bold. It was insulting all at the same time. Rabshakeh actually says it was Jehovah himself that gave the command and the approval to march into Judah and destroy the land. And friends, you know what Rabshakeh is using God like? A chess piece. Moving him around however he feels like. First he tells him, your God's not going to help you. Now he says, your God is my God who's going to help me, and he's told me to go and defeat you. Now let me tell you this. Rabshakeh was very smart. You talk about a brilliant person. Because whether Rabshakeh knew it or not, he was actually correct. Because it was God who was using Assyria in judgment against the nation of Israel. Turn back to Isaiah chapter 10. It's clear. And I'm not saying here that Rabshakeh knew and had been told directly by Jehovah to do this. I don't believe that was the case. But in some small way, he's actually correct. Because earlier in the book, Isaiah had prophesied that God would pick Assyria to be the rod of his anger in order to defeat and take the people, his own people, into captivity. Look in verse 5. "O Assyrian," God speaking, "the rod of mine anger, the staff in their hand, is mine indignation. I will send him," I will send Assyria, God will send Assyria, "against a hypocritical nation." Friends, that's Israel. That's Judah. "And against the people of my wrath will I give them a charge, to take the spoil, to take the prey, to tread them down like the mire of the streets." We'll stop there. But it had been prophesied by Isaiah that because of the sin and the idolatry and the hypocrisy of the nation of God's people, he would raise up Assyria in judgment. So as we come here back to verse 10, we could say there was some partial truth to what Rabshakeh was doing, because God had led the Assyrians to come against Judah and Jerusalem. What Rabshakeh was doing was using a daring strategy to attempt to scare the Jews into the deal. What we find here is a clear belief that Rabshakeh at this meeting was at this meeting for one reason and one purpose only, and the verse tells you. Notice what he says. "The Lord has said unto me, I am not here to get your money. What am I actually here for?" What's the verse say? "I'm here to get your land and to destroy it." At this point, Rabshakeh just tells it as it is. He says, "Well, God is the one that's told us to come." I think he was making that up, to be honest. I don't think God had told him specifically, but God was using the nation. And now he says, "You can't trust in Egypt. You can't trust in your God. Your God has actually sent me and our nation to actually take all of your land and all of your people." Well, I'll give Rabshakeh this much. At least he was honest to this extent. Let's continue. Rabshakeh now threatens the Jewish people. Next two verses. If you think this is bad enough, it gets worse. Then said Elkayam and Shebna and Joah unto Rabshakeh, speak, I pray thee, unto thy servants in the Syrian language, for we understand it. And speak not to us in the Jews' language in the ears of the people that are on the wall. The only thing that Elkayam, Shebna, and Joah said in this whole time is recorded right here. All they said to him was, they turned to Rabshakeh, and they said, Rabshakeh, could you please speak in a different language? Now, why would they say that? Why would he tell them to quit speaking in the Jews' language and speak in the Syrian language? First of all, the Syrian language was the diplomatic language of the day. So that makes some sense. But there's another reason. Yes, I know you know, Ryan, why the reason is. The reason that he chose to have, they chose to ask him that was because they knew that if all those people that were nearby, and by the way, there would have been Jewish soldiers and people nearby, probably within earshot, and we'll see that in just a moment, and they could hear what Rabshakeh was saying. And so these men, these Jewish men said, could you please speak in a different language? And they didn't say this out loud, but we're fearful that these men that are going to fight for us are going to hear this, and that's going to scare them. So they knew that Rabshakeh's words would put fear into the soldiers and other people nearby if they heard them. So they requested the Assyrians to speak in the Syrian language and not the Jewish language. But you know what Rabshakeh said? Phooey on you, I'm going to speak what I want to speak. So he refuses the request and he continues to speak. Verse 13, Rabshakeh, now, by the way, responding to that request didn't make him any happier. He gets more bold. He stands up and he shouts. In other words, if he was just speaking normally and these Jewish diplomats said, could you change your language in regard to hoping that the other people couldn't hear him? You know what Rabshakeh said? Forget that. Not only am I not going to change my language, I'm going to yell it so everybody can hear it. And so he lifts his voice up in the Jews' language, verse 12, and then verse 13, it says that as well. And he says this, he says, hath my master sent me to thy master to speak these words? Hath he not sent me to the men that sit upon the wall? That's why I know that Rabshakeh, that there were other people nearby, because that's what the verse tells us. So Rabshakeh says, I'm not come here to really speak to you guys. I'm not really even here to speak to your king or your master, Hezekiah. I'm here to give a message to those people on the wall, the soldiers, to scare them into submission. And then he says this, these men that sit upon the wall, I want them to know that soon they will eat their own dung and drink their own urine. What does that mean? Here's what his response of deep scorn and ridicule. As he says that his master, Sennacherib, had sent him not to give a message to the king, but to a message to all of Judah to say this, the people on the wall are doomed. They're doomed because we have you surrounded, and we will sit here until you have no food left and nothing to drink. And then what happens, friends? When nations did this and surrounded cities and they cut off the food supply and the water supply, you know what happens. All the food and water is gone. People start eating each other and their animals. And when that's exhausted, all they have left is to eat their own body waste to survive. Friends, that's what Rabshakeh was saying. We'll stay here until we starve you to death. So you better take our bargain. You better take our pledge. You better agree to this. Oh, got quiet in here. Let all the people know this, Rabshakeh says. He says in verse 13, he stands up and he cries with a loud voice in the Jewish language and he says, hear ye the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. So no longer is he speaking mainly to the ambassadors. He's speaking to the soldiers on the wall and anybody that could hear him. And he's saying this, we will win. Friends, the Assyrians, as clearly shown by Rabshakeh and his scorn and mockery and ridicule, they think they're in control, don't they? It's obvious. He basically takes the corkscrew and he just screws it right into the people's hearts. And he says, you don't have anybody to trust. Egypt won't help you. Your God won't help you. Your God's actually for us. If you don't follow this, we're going to force you to starve and eat your own body waste. The Assyrians thought they were in total control, but what they did not know was that God was sovereignly orchestrating all of this, and he would not let them destroy Jerusalem or the entire people. Rabshakeh thought his master, my king, the great king, was in control of this situation, but he was about to be in for a rude awakening. Well, let's finish today the complete humiliation of Judah. Verse 13. Rabshakeh continues, well, we've already looked at verse 13, and here in this speech from 13 through 20, what we have is Rabshakeh purporting that his king and his nation is greater than God. That's what he's going to say right now. If you want to put it in a nutshell, that's what he's going to say. He's greater than your God, he's greater than Hezekiah, and he's greater than your people. Edward Young said this, in this position and in these words that Rabshakeh is about to say, the voice and attitude of Satan are manifest. In other words, this man is controlled by the devil himself. He goes on. This man represents the kingdom of man. Unregenerate, self-sufficient man. In other words, we're stronger than you. That now speaks. And he is confident that Yahweh is merely a god like any other god. And can be just embraced into man's empire, unquote. In other words, he not only uses Jehovah as a pawn, he just says, he's just like any other god. We're just going to overcome him just like we've done all the other gods. Verse 14, because here comes the ultimatum. At this point, Rabshakeh is just going to lay it down and he's just going to bring the thunder. He says in verse 14, thus saith the king, again, the king of Assyria. And remember, he's speaking to everybody now. He's speaking to anybody that can hear him, including the people that are guarding the next walled city, if I could say it that way. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not deliver you. The king had spoken. And on his authority, you better listen to me, Rabshakeh says. Do not allow Hezekiah to deceive you, you people on the wall, into trusting that the Lord will deliver you. Because I'm going to tell you, he won't. That's what he tells him. What a backwards message. The world empire of the day is now telling the city of God, Jerusalem, and God's people to listen to its king, the Assyrian king, and not Jehovah. Meanwhile, as we think about the backdrop, Isaiah, earlier in the book, had seen a vision of God, had he not? He had seen a vision of the Lord high and lifted up. For 40 years, Isaiah had spoken Jehovah's message to the people. He had commanded the people to repent. Over and over throughout the book so far, we have seen, up to the time of Hezekiah, the people rejected God's message through Isaiah. They had mocked the Lord, had they not? They had denied that they even wanted him to be their God. Now these people, led by Hezekiah, had begun to reform the land, get rid of the groves, get rid of the false worship, the false idols, the work of men's hands. And now they were facing, though, the stark reality that if they didn't listen, their choice to follow man and not God would cause them to be defeated if that's the way they went. You see, the choice was out there for them. They could try to follow Assyria and do what they wanted, or they could fully put their trust in God. That's really the two choices. That's all they had. If it was ever apparent in the Bible, here it was. Hezekiah wanting to follow God, right? Assyria saying, we've got you surrounded. Don't worry if you don't, just quit following your God. We just agree to follow us. Where have we heard this before? It's like the world says that to us, is it not? Don't listen to biblical leadership. Don't listen to your Bible. Don't listen to your God. Just follow us, and it'll be so much better. Friends, it won't. It won't be better. Let's look on. He repeats himself, neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. The city will not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. So in other words, don't believe Hezekiah when he says that you will be defeated with the help of Jehovah. Don't believe that, he says. This man knew everything. He knew the words that were the right words for the ambassadors to say back to him. In other words, he spoke them before they could speak them. He knew what they were going to say. This is incredible. And by the way, the right words, don't you believe? The right words for the ambassadors to say back to them would have been this. Now, I know the end of the story says it differently because Hezekiah told them don't say anything. But the right words in the spiritual language of the day, in the biblical way of the day, would have been to said, we're not going to listen to you. We're going to trust the Lord. That's what he said. And you know what he said? Don't worry. Don't do that. Don't even tell me that. Because it's not true. It's not true. Your God's not strong enough to defeat my king. Continuing. What Rabshakeh was doing was accurately analyzing the heart of Hezekiah. Friends, Hezekiah's heart was to trust the Lord. Rabshakeh was analyzing and saying exactly what Hezekiah was doing. He was correct. He had found his confidence in God. That's Hezekiah. Hezekiah believed at this point in his life, at least as I study this, that he had come to a place that Jehovah would remember his promises and deliver his people. Hezekiah believed that. And we're going to see that in the next chapter in his prayer. Friends, that gives us another lesson for today. When the people like the Assyrians, the representative of the world, or lukewarm Christians mock your confidence or our confidence in God, we know then we are on the right path of obedience and trust before God. If you're trusting God and people are mocking you, let it be known you're on the right path. Amen. Let it be known today, friends, that that's what's going to happen to us. But continue to trust God. Know you're on the right way and doing the right thing and keep doing it. Verse 16, hearken not to Hezekiah. He just straight out says it. Don't listen to Hezekiah. Thus saith the king of Assyria, make an agreement with me. Okay, sign on the dotted line. Buy a present and come out to me. Eat every one of your own vine and every one of your fig tree. Drink every one of the waters of his own cistern. Just real quickly, got to finish this up. Don't listen to Hezekiah. He says, sign the treaty and make peace with Assyria. That's what he says. Make peace with the world. Have we heard that before? Just follow us. And look at the promises, friends. What's the promise? You'll get everything you need. Oh, look, you get to stay in your land. You get your vines. You get your grapes. Oh, good. Get your figs. You'll get all the water you ever need from your own land. You get to stay in your own land. Just sign the agreement. Follow the way of the world. Sign up. And you'll get all the blessings of the physical that you need, friends. But notice the next verse. Until I come and take you away. To a land that's better than your land. A one like your own land, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards. He says, sign on the dotted line. Everything will be just good. You'll get all the good things you need right off your land until we come attack you and take you away. Historians tell us that it's possible Sennacherib was pulled away from this battle for a while to battle Egypt. And the word would on the street would have been that Rabshakeh said, when my king comes back and takes you over. So basically, you'll have a time period where you can remain in your land and we won't attack you. Just sign the treaty, pay us our money. But when he comes back, let it be known. And then notice what he says. We're going to take you back to our land. Now, friends, the Assyrians, when they took people captive, didn't do it very nicely. He says, we're going to take you to a land just like yours. All the corn and drink you want, all the bread and vineyards you want, it'll be nice. You know what he failed to tell them? About the rigors and the barbaric ways that they took their captives back to their land of Assyria. He didn't say anything about that. He didn't say anything about their punishment if they disobeyed, which would have been death. He didn't say of the hardships of being moved from the known world of their day to a foreign controlled place. In exchange for a better land or a land just like theirs, here's what you have to give up. Just give up all your freedoms. Just come with us. We'll make everything good for you. Just imagine if social media would have been around that day, because the people of Israel who had already been taken to Assyria, maybe they could have been typing on Facebook saying, this isn't so good. They tricked us. Because historical accounts tell us that the people of Israel didn't fare very well when they were taken captive to Assyria. Verse 18, he continues, beware lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. Hath any of the gods of the nations delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arphad? Where are the gods of Seraphim? And have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who are they among all the gods of these lands that have delivered their land out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand? I'll be just summarized because our time is done here. But the Assyrian ambassador asks, what have happened to the gods that we've attacked in the past? Well, let me answer. They were overrun by Assyria. He mentions four different areas. And the main one I want you to see is Samaria. Samaria was the capital of Israel. Let me tell you this. You know what he was saying? What did the gods of Israel, by the way, what an indictment on Israel. Because they were worshiping lots of false gods. Baal, Samaria was the capital. And what we have here is, you know what? The gods of all these other lands, they did nothing to stop us, he says. We overran them, lickety split. They couldn't even put a fight up against us. In other words, these gods thought they could defend their land and been able to deliver their people, but they couldn't, including the false gods of Israel, by the way. They couldn't defeat Assyria either. And the emphasis on this is in verse 20, it's my hand. The Assyrian hand. Notice he says it several times. My hand has done this. Or King Sennacherib has done this. Those gods have been worthless. Have been nothing they could do. This man is overly confident that since Jehovah is just like the other defeated gods, or so he thinks, he will no more be able to save them than any of these other already humiliated gods of other nations. He goes on and says, Yahweh will not be present to help the people of Judah. Edward Young in his commentary said this, the devils believe and tremble. But the Rabshakeh, blinded by the power of the Assyrian king, thinks that the God against whom he is to fight is as impotent or powerless as the gods that are the creation of men's hands, unquote. In other words, he just likens Jehovah to the gods created by man. The response to the Assyrian demands, lastly today, demonstrates Judah's desire to follow the Lord. What were the response of the ambassadors? What would you have said, by the way? What would you have said if you had been an ambassador? You know what? You shouldn't have said anything. And that's what they did. But they held their peace, verse 21, and they answered him not a word, for that was the king's commandment, was to say, do not answer them. Then came Eliakim and Shebna and Joah back to Hezekiah, and they tore their clothes and told him the words of Rabshakeh. The first response for these men, the Judean men now, was to say absolutely nothing. Hezekiah, I believe, was trusting Jehovah. And since the enemy clearly despised God and thought nothing of his power, the best response was to be quiet. In fact, even if they had said anything, it wouldn't have done any good. But the Assyrians were about to find out that the God they thought was just like other gods was actually in total control of this entire conflict. The second thing, the response in verse 22, was to return to Jerusalem and to mourn over the impending situation. So what can we learn today? When we look at a chapter that's mostly an historical account of mockery of God, Rabshakeh didn't understand who God was. He didn't realize how great and powerful Jehovah was. He didn't understand Jehovah and his sovereign workings in man's lives. He didn't understand any of that. But friends, we know about it, and we can learn something today. First of all, do not let people attract you to anything other than full trust in the Lord. That's what Rabshakeh was trying to do. He was trying to attack true believing people to follow the world. It's the lie of the enemy from the beginning of the garden. The Assyrians tried to attract the people of God to their position, to follow their ways. And we'll give you the good things of this world. Friends, it is not about the good things of this world. It's about God and trust and how powerful and who he is. Number two, when we are faced with the enemy's deceptive tactics, remember how God has delivered you in the past and his promises of salvation in the future. And Hezekiah did that, friends. He knew about how God had delivered this nation in the past, and he believed that God would deliver him in the future. We need to remember that. And number three, sometimes the best thing in response to those who would oppose us is to walk away in silence and mourn and pray for their spiritual condition. Sometimes the best thing when people do this to us is to not say a word. And I know we should be a testimony. And I know there are certain times that we need to say things. I don't think anything back to this person would have done any good. Are there people that have done this to you, friends? We need to pray. It's a reminder of their spiritual condition and their need for spirit to be spirit-filled and to have the Holy Spirit within them. Let's close.